A foreign nation is a kind of contemporaneous posterity. H.B. Wallace. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to say thank you to everyone joining me this week. I appreciate all the support. And if any new listeners are dropping by, thank you as well. I hope you will enjoy this and go back and listen to our backlog. And to returning listeners, you guys are the best. So, we're still riding high in terms of downloads and numbers, so I appreciate you all. Now, we are going to be moving out of sub-Saharan Africa and into North Africa. And that's going to be our point of focus for a few episodes. This should be fairly long in terms of just like a single section, because there's a lot going on that we have records of. But I did want to, before we fully move into that, this episode is going to kind of be a little bit of a transitional episode. It's also going to be dealing with some things that are maybe out of order in terms of what the focus of the podcast is. But mainly that's going to be because I'm going to be using terminology for things that are happening in the future, for things now. Just so people have a little bit of time, better understanding it, and you'll be able to conceptualize, hopefully, a little better. And it'll give you, like, a frame of reference for when we get back here going forward. So, this week, we're going to be talking about how the Nile Valley is a boundary, but it doesn't quite divide sub-Saharan Africa and Northern Africa in quite the same way the Sahara does. So we'll be talking about that. We'll also be going into the peoples living there, the material cultures that we know about. And we're also going to talk a bit about, again, terminology from the past to kind of help describe what is going on. And we're also going to be diving into the Egyptian religion and mythology. Because believe it or not, we are in the pre-dynastic period in Egypt. Though, before that, we will be talking about their neighbors directly to the south, the people of Kush and Yam, and what today is collectively referred to as Nubia. First, though, I want to talk about the Nile, because as Herodotus said, and I believe I quoted him prior episodes, but Egypt is the gift of the Nile. And not just Egypt. Kush and Nubia as well. Now, we discussed the etymology of the Nile a bit when talking about its branches, but the name came to English from the Latin Nilus, which derived from the name from the river from Greek Nelos, which they probably got from the Semitic root word Nahal, which just meant river. Though I am a little confused about the explanation, because why did they use a Semitic or proto-Semitic term for the name? Why did the Greeks use that? Many Semitic languages were spoken that the Greeks interacted with in the Middle East and the Levant, but they were interacting with the Egyptians too for a very long period of time as well. And even probably before Greek was Greek, they were interacting. So I couldn't really get a solid explanation or come up with my own, at least a plausible theory of why the Greek term didn't evolve from the Egyptian name for the river. So I'm going to have to look into this. This is something I'm going to look, I'm interested in getting some information about. Another interesting fact I found when I was researching this is that the original version of the Old Testament, the Nile is just called Yor, or Hayor, meaning the river. And I find it interesting that the Hebrew, being a Semitic language, didn't use Nahal as a base either. So that's another thing that I have to look into and dive into and investigate. As for the Egyptians, they actually had several names for the Great River. First, they had Jeteru, or Iteru. And this could mean a generic stream or river, but to the Egyptians, there was really no other river. So the Nile was the Iteru. They would also refer to it as Api, which is the Egyptian god representing the annual flooding of the Nile. We'll talk more about him later. He's a very interesting figure. They would also call it Ar, or Our, and that's A-U-R, or A-R. And that was probably a shortened or slang form of Iteru. But essentially, it would eventually come to mean, like, the color black, or more specifically, the color of the dark mud that the river carried along and, you know, helped spread kind of the nutrition and silt and all that stuff along the Nile. So they actually have a couple of different terms for kind of that dark color. There's like the mud version, and then there's the soil, the actual soil itself. And we'll talk about that here in just a moment. But the Coptic term, which is a very late form of Egyptian, it evolved from the ancient Egyptian language, will be the Coptic term for the river will be Ior, or Ior. So that's I-O-R. So it's hard to piece together, but Ior shows connections to both Iteru and Our. Now, Ar meaning black is a bit confusing because the Egyptians, again, had another more widely used term for black, and this is Kim, which they associated with the kind of the fertile black soil of the land around the Nile. One of the endonyms the Egyptians used for their country was Kemet, and this meant literally the black or dark land. And this is where where the Greeks got Egyptos, or Egyptus, which the French turned into Egypte, and from there that entered into Old English as Egypte, and then that became just Egypt. And we'll talk about some of the other names they used for themselves later. For now, though, I want to turn to the Nile and how its course kind of shaped the bounds of Egypt, Kush, its people, the neighbors of all those people, even in these very early, early days. Today, the blue and white Nile converge at the city of Khartoum, and this is the capital of modern-day Sudan. Khartoum is relatively new in the grand schemes of human history. It was founded in 1821 AD, and from what I can tell, there was never really a permanent settlement there of any real size. But some human remains and tools have been found there dating to around 5,000 BCE, which is right around the middle of this season, which again, 6,000 to 4,000 BCE. From what we have found, though, this shows nothing larger than possibly a village. And if it is a village, it's a very small one. There were a number of small sites all around this region that have evidence of hunting and gathering, fishing, as well as pottery production, which may have been brought to the region from either North Africa, somewhere in the Sahara, or from the Near East, or possibly it was developed independently. We're not sure. But there will be other settlements and cities to the north and to the east along the White Nile before the convergence point. But by and large, this region will not see permanent habitations until later periods. And this is the very southern boundary of the region the Egyptians called Kush. And I talked last week about the Cushitic languages and how this region gave its name to that family, but I don't think I talked about the etymology for Kush. Essentially, we don't know where the term comes from exactly, but most think the Egyptians got the terms from the Kushites themselves. They seem to have maybe called themselves Kasu, and when the Egyptians referred to them with that term, they usually added a derogatory term when mentioning the region or some of its people. Foul Kush, perfidious Kush, etc. I also talked about the Egyptian term that they used for the region, or at least the southern part of their country, the northern part of Kush. They also use the term Ta-Seti, which translates literally to the curved land. And this is usually translated as the land of the bow. This was in reference to the skills of the archers of this region, which must have been impressive, as the Egyptians were fairly skilled with bows as well. And with the animosity between the Egyptians and their neighbors to the south, it must have been, you know, hard to acknowledge the fact that they were so good. Or maybe it was a warning, maybe something that the Egyptians said to keep in mind themselves of the dangers that their enemies could pose to them. Or it, maybe it's something that they recognized as their southerners, the southern Egyptians, or the upper Egyptians being better with the bow than maybe people from lower Egypt. But interestingly enough, the Egyptians also used the term nine bows, or besejet, or pejet, to describe outsiders or foreigners or foreign countries as a whole, when they would talk about everyone outside of Egypt, or a number of countries outside their home, it would be Pejet. Of course, they had specific names for specific foreigners, and who they included as being part of the Nine Bows changes as time goes on, as these other kingdoms or tribal identities fell apart and gave way to new kingdoms and identities. Another term the Egyptians used for their southern border region was Ta-Kentet, or Ta-Kentet, which literally means the frontier or borderland. Now, as some of you may know or may have guessed at, from what I've been speaking about, Egypt's southern border was not always stable. It ebbed and flowed as time went on. And the Egyptians, of course, learned more about the regions to the south and developed new terms and subdivisions for these regions and peoples. Today, this collection of regions is referred to as Nubia. And the term probably comes from the Egyptian word for gold, which I believe was Nub. Though the Egyptians never called the region this, at least in the written records. It may have been like a slang term. But in the official records, well, first let me say, like Egypt, Nubia can be divided into an upper and lower Nubia. And like Egypt, lower Nubia is in the northern section, and the upper region is in the south. And like with upper and lower Egypt, these terms refer to the elevation of the land instead of a direction. And Egyptian records make mention of various types of expeditions to places called Wawat, Irjet, Setu, and Yam. Wawat was in upper Egypt. Yam was in lower Egypt. Wawat was in upper Nubia. Yam was in lower Nubia. Irjet and Setu's locations are debated. Some think they were in lower Nubia, like Wawat. Others say they were in upper Nubia, like Yam. Or they could have been split between the two regions. And Kush, or the kingdom of Kush, would be close to the middle of these two regions. And then, of course, there were different peoples living in this region, and the Egyptians used several names for them. Though, again, we do need to be careful, as the Egyptians may not have always been the best at differentiating between these various constituent groups. Or even, they may not even cared about properly identifying people, as separate ethnic groups. But there was Nehesu, and this is translated as Nubian, but was usually referring to the peoples living directly along the Nile to the south. Egyptians would depict them with very dark black skin and with sharp cropped hair, dreadlocks, and sometimes this hair was painted, dyed, or caked red, though I have seen other people say that this is a kind of a leather hat or helmet. These peoples were also depicted with different ornamentation than the Egyptians. They usually are shown wearing necklaces of what may have been ostrich shells, Their kilts are also being depicted more colorfully than the average Egyptian kilt. The men are usually wearing white linens or kind of maybe a very light brown linen. Another term to describe the peoples of Nubia was Setu, and this meant bowmen. So Setu, Taseti, etc. You can kind of get where I'm going with that. And there was also Wawayu, which is, of course, is related to Wawat. So these may have been people specifically from the Wawat region of Nubia. And, of course, there was Kesu, or the Keswu, which, of course, is Kushites, as the kingdom of Kush was usually written as, or pronounced as, or we think it was pronounced as Kes. And now's a good time to talk about race and the ancient Egyptians. So, first and foremost, nothing is 100% sure, but it should be noted that the Egyptians did not view race and ethnicity like most people in the modern world do. They did not particularly discriminate against people as long as they were born in Egypt or lived in Egypt, spoke Egyptian, and made the proper offerings to the Egyptian gods for, you know, whatever religious festivals or obligations that they had. They served the obligations that was due to the pharaoh or their local government. Typically speaking, the Egyptians saw those peoples as Egyptian. And we have, you know, we have like actual evidence that there were black Egyptians. They had themselves depicted on their tombs. Several of them are in very high stations. There are, of course, black pharaohs. Though which ones are black and which ones are not is not always very clear, and there is a debate on some of these. But it should be noted that as a whole, when not depicting individuals, because an individual, if he's making his tomb, he wants himself depicted. But whereas the Egyptians are trying to depict their country and its people as a whole, they don't depict themselves quite as dark as they do the Nubians or the Nahesu or the Kushites. But they do depict themselves darker than some of their neighbors in other lands, Libya, the Levant, those places. So it's important to keep in mind that our understanding of race isn't quite the same thing. The Egyptians usually depict their men as having darker, kind of reddish copper, kind of medium brown skin, and their women are depicted as lighter skin. They're usually depicted kind of with this yellow skin. So the Egyptians would kind of consider themselves, I guess, kind of a halfway point almost between the foreigners to the north, west, and east, and the foreigners to the south and the southeast and southwest. So please keep that in mind. Now, in terms of DNA evidence for this type of thing, we haven't really gotten any DNA samples that are usable from the oldest periods of Egyptian history. We have found some remains. Unfortunately, we've not been able to test DNA from those just yet. Though, we have made improvements in DNA testing and extracting ancient DNA, and we have obtained DNA from some sources in the Middle Kingdom period. These sources, and it's only, again, it's only one site in Egypt. Egypt is a very big place, so there's a number of locations. I think this is kind of towards the middle of the country, though. But from what we can see, comparing that DNA to modern Egyptians, there's quite a bit of overlap. But interestingly enough, the modern Egyptian population has more evidence of sub-Saharan African DNA being present than the Middle Kingdom does. Though, again, take that with some caution and just understand that this is just one site. And people may not have been traveling, or at least your average person was probably not traveling too far, even in those days. You may have been able to travel for religious reasons, but by and large, most people are tied to their land, with very few exceptions, or if you're part of a court or temple complex system or the army, you may not have been able to get around much. And we do have written accounts that, Egyptians in the south were darker skinned than the Egyptians living in the north. This could be due to a number of factors, possibly due to migrations of Asiatics or Nubians, what have you, or it could also just be an evolutionary process. People living closer to the tropics and the equator tend to have darker skin than people living to the north or south of those regions. But I think we'll find going forward that there probably will be some ancient Old Kingdom DNA that might be able to be deciphered and compared to later sources. I should point out a lot of earlier, Egyptologists did assume that the older Pharaonic kingdoms, or the Old Kingdom, was darker in complexion. They were Africans, and then that they were supplanted later by one of these waves of migration or invasion, which is everyone, classicists, that's like everyone's favorite excuse for why things change. They were invaded by these outsiders, which, as we're determining now, probably didn't happen quite as much as we thought, and never quite so simply. But we'll talk more about that later. Another change in complexion may be due to dietary reasons. These earlier peoples may have been more reliant on pastoralism. They're still getting a lot of nutrition, required nutrition, whereas maybe later peoples were more reliant on agriculture, and they weren't getting quite as much vitamins as they needed, and that may have been one of the causes for the lightening of skin. That's a theory anyway, and that's not just for Egyptians, that's everywhere. That's one of those things that's still kind of heavily debated. I will also point out that there have been some accusations by some Afrocentrists or African supremacists that the early Egyptologists essentially found all these statues with their African features, and they broke them up, smashed them, that kind of thing. And while there were certainly racists among the early Egyptologists, they almost all had a distinct respect and love for the culture in the country, and they didn't go around purposefully destroying things, at least not like something as obvious as a statue or carved jewels or jewelry or that kind of thing. That's something probably not very often. Though I do think Afrocentrists do have a point that probably the sub-Saharan influence on Egyptian culture has probably been underplayed. And I think that's something that a lot of modern Egyptologists are accepting. Though it should be clear, it's not a one-way street. These two groups, the Nubians, the Egyptians, the Proto-Nubians, the Proto-Egyptians, there's a lot of back and forth. And that lasts into the historical period. And we're going to talk about that. Before that, though, let's go ahead and finish up discussing kind of the geography and boundaries that the Nile provides to these two regions. Now, I've already talked about the lower Egypt being in the north, Upper Egypt being in the south. This is confusing, but again, it's due to the elevation of the land. Now, also, the Nile is, it's straightforward. It goes from the Ethiopian highlands, Blue Nile, White Nile. They flow north because of that elevation. And it's a very long river. However, it is not as strong everywhere, even after it combines. There are what are known as cataracts, and I've talked about them, I think, in prior episodes. But essentially, this is where the surface of the Nile is broken up by rocks, boulders, just jetting like pieces of land that kind of cut the river up. Now, some of these cataracts are not as bad as others, and the water's just shallow. It's a mix of shallow water and some rocks. And some of them are just, it's just a rocky and almost impossible just to sail through or go down. And the Nile has six primary cataract regions. Most of them are actually not in Egypt. In fact, five of the six are all found in what is today Sudan. That first cataract is near the modern city of Aswan. And today, of course, there's the lake, the Tashka Lakes, partially formed by the Aswan High Dam, Lake Nasser, that place. There's kind of that the Nile is flowing through those lake systems. In the past, that didn't exist. It was all one body. But Aswan is the last of the major Egyptian settlements, or at least it was back in the day. And so at some points, that would kind of be the end of Egyptian territory. Though at other times, it would get up to the second cataract and others later. But typically, for most of Egyptian history, as far as I'm aware, they never really moved past that second cataract. And the Egyptians would build forts kind of to the side of them eventually, kind of in later periods, to prevent larger armies, but also raiding and things like that. Not just to prevent raiding and things like that from the south, but also to enable them to raid and force tribute and extract tribute from people to the south. They used it both offensively and defensively. Khartoum is actually well past that sixth cataract, so that's probably why it wasn't targeted for like a large city by one of the various Nubian peoples. But a number of cities will sprout up at various ranges between the third and the sixth cataract. That's where a number of city-states will rise in Nubia, Kush, and some of which will become the centers of fairly large Kushite kingdoms or Nubian kingdoms, what have you. Typically, the cities that dominated Kush were built somewhere between that fourth and sixth cataract. They never went really further south than the sixth cataract. Well, their cities were never below that. They obviously had influence and trade and economic value there. And they probably had some smaller settlements a little past that sixth cataract. But south of the sixth cataract, you have a little bit of ways. And then you have where the blue and the white now meet. And again, Khartoum, people were living there, but it was never a large city center until the 1800s AD. Now, the oldest of these Kushite cities, at least as far as we know so far, is Kerma. And today it's in ruins. It's about 32 miles north of the city of Dongola, and that's around 50 kilometers, give or take. There is evidence of habitation at Kerma during this season. We have evidence that it was first occupied last season, actually, but right around 8,200, 8,300, somewhere around there. And it was occupied by hunter-gatherers who were beginning to make the transition to probably pastoralism, if not at that early stage, then very shortly after. However, from that period until right around 5,500, 5,100 or so BC, the site was almost completely abandoned. There's a number of reasons that this is thought to have happened. The most likely culprit is that the Nile may have been experiencing kind of like a lower level of flow. It's possible there may have been like a small branch that kind of the Nile maybe shifted in course just a little bit. But this is a fairly brief hiatus. After that 5,100 time frame, people began to move back. Now, after that, though, there is another period of hiatus, starting right around 4,000 BC. That's another period where the site's almost completely abandoned. However, by another 500 years, so 3,500 next season, the site will begin to be occupied full-time again. And it's at that point that you will see Kerma become a city-state. Now, all that being said, there is, again, evidence that there is a material culture associated with the peoples of Kerma. And not just of Kerma. They had some sites to the north and to the south. And they go through a couple of stages. Some of these stages show evidence of interaction with culture groups in Egypt and vice versa. But that's all stuff that we'll dive into when we begin to talk about pre-dynastic Egypt and, of course, the early dynastic period. Now, there are going to be other city-states that come about later, some found by people who are, you know, related to Kerma, but then there will also be other peoples, peoples that are maybe not directly related, but who were probably heavily influenced by the Kerma culture, or the Kingdom of Kerma. And again, this is going to be something that we'll dive into when we get to Egyptian history. Unfortunately, we don't know much about these people from themselves. A lot of what we know at this very early period all comes from Egyptian records and stories. Now, there is another big Neolithic site dating to this period in kind of the Nubian desert area, and we talked about it a lot last season, and that, of course, is Nabta Playa. Now, I talked about the fairly extensively last season. Talked about the cattle cult and things like that, and this is kind of really kicking into high gear during this season. And there's a lot of things happening at Nabta Playa. It kind of has really begun to explode. We talked about how it was a fairly large population center as early as the 7000 BC. And I say relatively large, of course. You're still kind of bound by the weather and the rain. But of course, the Sahara is starting to dry. But this region may not have been hit quite as bad. It's kind of built to retain water a little easier, and it being close to the Nile may have seen more regular rainfall and stayed greener for longer. Right around the start of this season, there's that kind of explosion of the cattle cult to right around 6,000 to 5,500. You see a lot more in-depth and really well thought out buildings and burials of cattle, and these kind of built up stone, I guess you'd call them graves. Tumuli is a term that you see a lot in the scientific archaeological literature. For those that believe that the southern Nubians had a very kind of strong influence on Egyptian religion. They make links between this site and the kind of the cattle cult with the cult of Hathor, who's an Egyptian goddess. She had a couple of different functions, but she was kind of like one of her roles, I should say, was as a protector of people in the night when they're in these more desolate desert regions. So it's possible that she is one of these gods that is kind of formulated in the south and then works her way north, and perhaps got conflated with some goddesses or gods there, and vice versa. That's just one of the kind of the theories regarding the cattle cult at Nabta Playa. And we'll talk about Hathor. She's very important for a number of reasons. And, of course, there's a very big megalithic stone structure, stone circle, called the Calendar Circle. They're thought there's a number of records of astrological events aligning with the Belt of Orion, Sirius, those stars. There's a lot of different theories on this, some of which are, again, a little fantastic, but there are others that kind of tie it into kind of measuring and marking when the summer solstice is going to start, which is the beginning of the rainy season, or it was the beginning of the rainy season for the region. And this would have been a little before the season began, to about the 5,500 or so. But again, as time goes on, it seems like they become much more organized and new stone circles are constructed. And around, I think, 4,800 BC is the one that is very closely aligned with like a new, possibly a more accurate summer solstice beginning. And it's around that period again, too, that you start to really see kind of the height of the cattle cult and those tumulus mounds being built. There's pottery at this site even before agriculture shows up. Again, and not that Nabta Playa has much evidence of agriculture. Again, this appears to be a site occupied mostly by pastoral hunter-gatherers, but it's occurring, you know, not too far from the Nile where people are practicing agriculture. A lot of the experts think that the pottery here is more closely aligned with the pottery you find in lower Nubia as opposed to upper Egypt. Though there are some instances where you do have more Egyptian style pottery. And that's, again, probably evidence of early, if nothing else, trade links, if not early interactions with people at this kind of religious site. And there had to have been some type of organized group effort to build this place. Some of the stones used for these megalithic structures are very heavy, a couple of tons. So they were found nearby. They're not being carted, you know, huge amounts of distances, but, you know, they would definitely have to be worked as a team to get them kind of aligned correctly. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to call it for this week. I do want to go over the material cultures found in Upper Egypt next week and Lower Egypt as well. We'll see if I'm able to cover both. But after that, I do want to talk about the Egyptian faith and kind of their cosmology and how they understood the world to exist. Because, as I said, we're getting very close to a historic period in time, at least for the Egyptians, where they're actually recording things. Now, not quite there just yet, but there is a lot of things that, by the time you get to the historic period, they are firmly established. So they have to have been established earlier for them to be that well thought out, well articulated, well kind of put forward. So I don't think it's insane to think that these are things that they are formulating or have formulated by this point in time. So I hope you all look forward to that. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I think it's one of the better ones I've been able to do. I really am looking forward to covering this part of Africa in the future, and of course going forward in the next couple of episodes too. And then we'll complete kind of the north westish of Egypt in Africa, Libya, Morocco, those kind of places. And then we'll be moving on to Asia, but still a couple of weeks here. So, again, I hope you've enjoyed. If you have any questions or feedback, please let me know. You can reach me via email at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter. My DMs are open. You can comment on the YouTube videos. I stream live on YouTube during the week, sometimes on the weekends. You're welcome to drop by there. Drop a subscription wherever you prefer to listen to the show. But yeah, thank you all so much. I hope you've enjoyed, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and a good rest of your week whenever you listen to the show. So thank you all. I'll see everyone next time. Goodbye.